Front Street this morning. If you didn't get a copy of what was passed out last Sunday, starting in chapter 22, the next three lessons, if you don't have that, you'll need that eventually. I can get that to you now. I've got copies of this available as well. We're not on it yet, but we will get to it. You will. Okay. We're in chapter 18 this morning of the book of Job, and page 15 in your handouts. Okay, we're in the midst of these discussions, these dialogues, these exchanges between Job and his friends. We've been putting friends in quotation marks. They've not been true friends because of what they've been saying. So we'll pick up with Bildad's speech, his second speech, in just a moment. All right, let's begin with prayer. Albert, would you lead us in a word of prayer before our class begins, please? All right, very briefly, let's review what we talked about Wednesday night. Job responding to Eliphaz, and as you have no doubt seen by now, as you've seen the material enough to know how we've got it parsed out, they're looking at all these speeches in terms of rounds or dialogues. Each friend will speak twice. Only Eliphaz and Bildad will speak a third time. Zophar will not speak after his speech that we're going to cover in material either today or Wednesday night, the Lord willing. But we concluded Eliphaz's speech Wednesday night and Job's response. He again complains about his condition before God. He's also complaining that friends have been unhelpful, disappointing to him. Chapter 16, you are miserable comforters. You're not friends at all. He then returns to complaining against how God is treating him. He feels God's being unfair. He's not treating him as he ought. Something that Tom said to me Wednesday night after class, let's not forget. Now, this is when we have up on the chart that Job is saying, well, he's complaining against God, it's all God's fault. That's how Job sees it. But as students of the book, which that's what we are, we know who's behind all this. Who is it? It's the devil. Job didn't know that. First chapter of the book, recall the conversation between God and Satan. Job was not privy to that. So Job is, that's why he says what he says throughout the book. But we know better. So Job continues to make those complaints. He spends time mourning in sackcloth and ashes. He's weary, flushed from continual weeping. Verse 17 of chapter 16, there's no violence in my hands. My prayers are pure, but yet God treats me this way. I don't deserve to be treated the way I'm being treated. That's what Job is lamenting continually. But he still has hope. His hope, as we discussed Wednesday night, is a heavenly vindication. Job doesn't see any vindication on the earth. He's not going to get any justice down here as he sees it, but he still has hope that in the end it'll all work out because my hope, my witness, some versions say my evidence is in heaven. It's not here on the earth. And that's what he spoke toward the end of chapter 16. And then as we concluded, don't cover my blood up was a reference back to even as early as Genesis chapter 4. as we examine that God's told Cain, the blood of thy brother crieth to me from the ground. God was aware of what had happened. And so Job is saying, don't cover my blood up. Let it speak. Because Job was convinced it would speak what about him? I'm innocent. I'm not guilty of what these friends are saying about me. And I know I've not sinned to deserve this punishment. So he wanted the blood. And that's just a metaphor. But that was the figure of speech that he used. And then we concluded in chapter 17 with another gloomy outlook on his condition. And we went through all these passages of how Job sees his current state before other people. Okay, so now we get to Bildad. And this is chapter 18. There's 21 verses in this chapter. His argument, he begins as he did before in his first speech, chapter 8 and verse 2. He asked the question, Job, how long are you going to keep this up? And he says the same thing in this chapter. How long? You'll see in chapter 16 and verse 2. How long will you hunt for words? Look at the last part of verse 2. And again, take into account that we have different versions that use in the room. But basically, the last part of verse 2, what do you see Bildad saying? Right. My version says, show understanding and then we can talk. Meaning what? Job, if you'll just, kind of calm down here. And if you'll listen to us, which the friends thought themselves as the reasonable ones in this conversation, if you'll just listen to what we have to say, then you'll really see that we're really trying to help you. And we have the truth about this. And we'll really help straighten you out. So show some understanding. We can have a profitable discussion. Of course, as we've been examining, some of the things the friends have been saying, have they been true? Yes, they have. They have made some arguments that are true. But the problem is, as we've noticed, and we'll continue to notice, they're taking the truth. Can a person take truth and misapply it? And it's not as truthful anymore. It's still the truth that's been stated, but it's a problem with that, and that's what these friends are doing. So, in verses 3 through 4, and let me get Miss Noreen her material as I walk back here. Look at verses 3 and 4. Good to see you this morning. Bildad says something that seems to me he's rather defensive now. Job has been equally biting, has he not, in recent comments? Back to the friends. They started it. I'm not trying to make this a tit-for-tat kind of a thing. But they started some of the more caustic remarks. And Job took a lot. He really did. But Job has been responding a little bit more in kind in recent speeches. So, because of what Job has recently said, look at verses 3 and 4 of chapter 18. And he asks some rather rhetorical questions of Job. Trevor, what's he say in those verses? Yeah, we're not stupid, Job. Now, what we've been saying to you, but you're regarding us as just a bunch of blockheads who don't know what, you know. No, we're not stupid. They've based their reasonings on the wisdom of the ancients. Eliphaz based his on the vision that he thought he had from God and all these things. They thought they were rather enlightened men. But you see, Job, you're regarding us as dumb as beasts. We don't have any common sense. And so I take that to... Bildad's a little bit defensive about this. He's getting a little put out with Job's continual rejection of what these men are saying. Bill?
Show some understanding. Look at one standpoint. That's exactly what Job said. Just to understand.
Yes.
But they are saying, really, not show some understanding. But accept what we say.
Yes, show some agreement with us. That's what they're saying, yes. And that I think that would be correct. So, Bildad's a little put out with Job. So you see, each party is being put out with each other. And it's kind of a contest of wills up to this point. Who can outlast the other? Yes, Brother Harold. Yeah. Yes. Bildad is getting irritated with Job. And they want this discussion to be over. They just were convinced in their... How hard is it to talk to someone who is that convinced in their mind? It's pretty difficult. When they think, when they just know, now this is the way that it is, it's hard to convince a person. And these three friends, I think we can categorize them so. And Bildad's words, I think, at this point, show that. Yes, Bill. Yes, that's right. You can't tell me such and so. And as long as your mind is that closed, that's correct. You cannot tell a person so. Okay. Now look at verses 5 through 19. Bildad then proceeds in another long discourse. And this seems rather redundant, I know, but this is a major theme of the friends' position and their theology. He, like the other two have done, Bildad again returns to this big, long discussion of the wicked. How God's going to deal with them. How they're going to at last find themselves when God is through with them. And again, we'll find some things in this passage that are true. They are true statements. But we need to make sure that we're not misapplying truth. And in this case, that's what Bildad was doing again, misapplying truth. Notice these passages. Verses 5 through 6, Bildad says, there's no light in his life. The wicked has no light in his life. Well, is that always true? Is that generally true? It's generally true. Will there never be any light in the life of the wicked? Now, we know there won't be at last. He'll suffer because he's not been faithful to God. But is there nothing ever good in the life of a wicked person? I don't think you can say that. They enjoy some things in life. Now, if empty, I mean, it doesn't have any real lasting value. But that was the problem with statements like this. So there's no light in his life. Look in verse 7. His steps have lost their vigor. That's true. In a sense, that is true. He will finally catch himself. He'll be done in by his own devices. And that is, a lot of times you'll see some of the Psalms teach that. One particular Psalm, number 9, verse 15. The schemes and the traps that the wicked lays to try to catch other people. Many times, who's it wind up catching? Himself. And so that is true. That is true. That's a true statement. But Bildad continues on with this discussion. He falls for hidden traps through verses 9 and 10. He suffers physically. That's true. Verses 12 through 13, you see him saying that. His strength is famished and calamity is ready at his side. His skin is devoured by disease. Now, who's that sound like? Sounds like Job. So if we take what Bildad is saying, what's he calling Job? If he's discussing the wicked, he wicked. Job, you're wicked. That would be an implication of what Bildad is saying. Another strong insinuation. He no longer enjoys security. Verses 14 through 16. That will at last fail him. He won't find any strength in life. And he eventually loses his posterity. Verses 17 through 19. Memory of him perishes from the earth. He has no name abroad. He's driven from light into darkness. Chased from the inhabited world. He has no offspring or posterity among his people, nor any survivor where he sojourned. Is that always true? I don't think that's always true. We can find some wicked people. They've got a long genealogy after them. So that's not absolutely true. It may be true in some cases, but not always true. But these are the arguments that he's making. Okay? And again, who lost his family? Who's going to be around to further Job's name? He don't have anybody. All his children are dead. And he's got a wife still, but even she turned on him and cautioned him to curse God and get it over with. But Job has no posterity. So again, I think we see some more strong insinuations from Bildad with respect to Job's character, how he's categorizing Job's situation. And then he confidently concludes by telling Job what is in store for him is what he has described. Look at verses 20 through 21. Those in the west are appalled at his fate, and those in the east are seized with horror. That takes care of both extremes. I mean, Bildad's got him either way he goes. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him who doesn't know God. Job, you don't know God. This is the plight that you're in. And again, just to remind ourselves, the three friends think that Job's suffering is due to what? Something sinful. Job has done something wrong. That's contrary to God's will. So here's what Bildad says. Now, has he said anything new that we haven't heard before? No, he hadn't said anything new. He really hasn't. Yes, he has been more adamant. But Job isn't hearing anything he hasn't already heard from either Eliphaz or Zophar. All right, now, with one swipe of the brush, seems like Bildad is just painting everybody the same with the same brush. And can you do that with success when you're dealing with people? You can't do that. Each situation is different. Now, I'm not saying we've got to water down truth and change truth to fit people. We don't do that, of course. But you can't just categorize everybody in the same way with the same words because people's situations are different. And Bildad is making, as they have been doing so far, making gross generalizations, assuming things not in evidence. That's what we borrow from the legal profession. They're making assumptions here, and they've got no proof of it. And yet they're telling Job, you need to listen to what we've got to say. So again, Bildad has done nothing new in the arguments. Now let's look at how Job responds to him, chapter 19, verses 1 through 29. He continues to protest the persistent arguments of the friends. Rob, read for us verses 2 and 3 of chapter 19. Now, yours says, break me in pieces with words in verse 2. Other versions have, crush me. How long will you crush me with words? That's how Job was feeling. He just felt just oppressed with argumentation. He's tormented and crushed. And he uses hyperbole. These 10 times. You know, as parents, we tell our children what? I've told you 100 times. Well, have we really done that? I don't think we have, unless we keep counting. I don't think we do that. But that's just an exaggeration. That's an emphasis of how many times I've had to deal with this situation with one of my children. Well, Job says, these 10 times is an indication of how weary he was and how exhausted he was by the arguments of these friends. I'm insulted, he says, these 10 times. You are not ashamed to turn. You have no shame. You've got nothing to prove what you've been saying. So Job again continues to show us how we see what he's saying, but his words tell us really how he feels at the hands or the expense of these his friends. Quote, his friends. Let's make sure we emphasize that. Verse 5. They have failed to prove his error. Look in verse 5. If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, if you could do that, which Job is not convinced they could, but he says, even if you could, again, what's Job's conclusion in verse 6? Okay, he goes back to this again. It is God that has wronged me. Some more strong language. Do all the versions say something to that effect? It is God that has wronged me. I don't deserve this. You haven't proved anything. It's not because of my sin that I'm getting this. God's doing this to me. So Job doesn't say anything new either. And then he begins another complaint against God, verse 12, of how he felt God has dealt with him. Let's read those verses. Trevor, would you read for us verses 7 through 12? That's that section, I believe, goes together of Job chapter 19. Notice in these verses all the times that Job said, he did this, God's done that, God's done this. He's attributing all this to God. More strong statements. Let's look at them real briefly. Here's what Job says God has done. Job's been crying for help, hasn't he? Been crying for answers. But saying violence, unfair, this isn't right. And what kind of answers has he gotten? Nothing. God's been silent. God's not answering Job like Job is wanting. So Job doesn't care for that. Look in verse 8. What has God done? He's walled me up. He's surrounded me. He's put me in this trap, and I can't get out. Look in verse 9. Your version said, glory. He's taken away my glory. Stripped me of my honor, some versions say. I've lost all my honor. I don't have any honor anymore among men. God's taken that away from me. That's how he felt. And again, let's be sure, Harold has reminded us a couple of times, has God really done this? The answer is no. God has not done this, but this is how Job felt. So let's make sure we understand that and remind ourselves of that. Verses 11 through 12, Job even saw himself as God's enemy. His troops come together, verse 12. God sent an army, and they're just attacking me. And of course, Job understands that who can fight against God? You can't fight against God. God's too powerful. So I don't stand a chance in this thing. God's done this to me. So again, Job launches out into this discussion of unfair treatment before God. Okay. Now he then, not only is that affecting him, afflicting his soul, tormenting and vexing him, he then turns to describe how other people have treated him. The previous verse is how he saw God treating him. Now he says, here's how other folks are treating him, other humans, starting in verse 13. He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. No friends. Verse 14. My relatives have failed. My intimate friends have forgotten me. Now, maybe Job is implying something now. Who could he be talking about? These three guys right here. Maybe. I don't know that for a fact, but maybe he's referring to them. They've not been very friendly to him. That's a possibility. Even domestic relationships have worsened. Look in verses 15 and 16. Those who live in my house and my maids or my servants, look on Job how? Stranger. I am a foreigner in their sight. I call to my servant. What does he do? He don't answer. I mean, Job's the boss, and he's the servant, and even the servant won't answer Job. Job has no honor. He's lost all prestige in life, totally, as he sees it. Lost it all. And I have to implore him with my mouth. A verse that we referenced way back when we introduced the book, how Job's physical condition affected his relationships. What does verse 17 teach us? His most intimate relationship. Even my wife finds me offensive. My breath. No doubt that was physically affected by his condition. In those sores and all that infection in his body. And so Job, I'm even offensive to my wife. That's even been harmed. That relationship has been affected. And verses 18 and 19. He mentions little children, doesn't he? What about little children who should have respected a wise old sage as he was, but how does Job describe him here? They despise me. They don't have any respect for me. So Job continues to talk about how he's been affected physically. Now, he started out with how he is affected with his God, and that's, of course, that's most important. But Job now says, let me discuss or lament how other people are treating me. As Job sees it, how's this life? Not good. Maybe that's not good right now. I don't see much good at all in life. I can't get any comfort physically. Racked with pain, I'm sure he was. All my relationships are out the window. I cry to my God, he doesn't answer me. I mean, does that leave everything? I mean, that's about everything, isn't it? I can't think of any other realm, any other relationship that could be. Yeah, but Job, you still have this. No, he didn't have anything as he saw it. But what did he still have that he's forgetting? He's got that. But does he still have his God? Had God turned his back on Job? No, he had not. Job thought he did, but God had not done that. And God would still say, what were the lines that we emphasized at the start of the book, chapters 1 and 2? If God would speak now, what would he still say? my servant Job. There's none like him in all the earth. He would still say that. I'm confident of that. God would still say that. He still holds to his integrity. He said some things that's not good, but he's not lost his faith, has he yet, Tom? He has not given it up. His faith is still there. Still there. Yes, sir. His record was in heaven. That is correct. That's where his witness is. That's where his evidence is. His vindication would not be earthly, but would be heavenly. So he's bemoaning how these things are affecting him. He felt he deserved pity because of his condition, but instead he's getting persecution. Verses 21 through 22. Verse 21, he says, pity me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Another strong statement. Why do you, look at verse 22, why do you persecute me, how? As God does, and are not satisfied with my flesh. So, we're seeing again how Job feels in all this. Yes, Charles. That is correct. That is correct. You don't have to say what you've been saying just because I think God's bearing down on me. We have a phrase, don't add insult to injury. And that's what they're doing. Really wearing on. Okay. That's a good question. That's true. I think that's a good observation. Yes, it would. He's searching for answers. He's just searching. And out of his search, Job is speaking in the frustration of his soul. And he can't understand why God won't answer him. Can't figure it out. Okay, but he concludes in hope. And we've seen some rather strong words in this chapter. But we have evidence, and the evidence is there in the text if we'll just search it out, that Job had not given up faith. Let's conclude the chapter now, starting in verse 23. Larry Wisdom, would you read for us Job 19, 23 through 29, please? There's some strong words from Job to the friends now. He's not done that before. But Job is finally speaking up with respect to warning the friends. They've been warning him. Now, Job, you better repent because you're going to lose your soul. And now Job is saying, look, you better watch what you're saying. God will hold you in account for what you say. You see that toward the end of this text. Now, here's some beautiful, beautiful phrases in this section. He wished his plight were permanently recorded for future generations to see. Now, he at least wants that. Yes, he did. We have it in the Scripture. That is correct. Good point, Bill. All right. But verse 25. Now, that would, through verse 24, would take care of future generations for them to read this account and see what happened. But verse 25. But as for me, as far as I'm concerned, what's Job say? I know my Redeemer. Does that sound familiar to you? We have a song by that name, don't we? We have a couple of them. In fact, and of course, this is not inspired, and I'm not trying to make anything out of this more than it should be. But you're looking at, I forget which number it is in this hymn book, one of the ones that is titled, this, it uses, the author uses Job 19 and verse 25 as the little scripture under the title. That may have been where he got the idea for that hymn. I know that my Redeemer lives, and shall he ever stand? I'm paraphrasing here, but you get the idea. And that's what Job says here. So Job says, Here's faith talking. That's how we know. Here's one reason how we know that Job has not totally given it up. I may be bad here on the earth, but my Redeemer lives. And not only that, but what does he also say in the end of verse 26? I'm going to see him. I know that. See, Job has not given up. He's not quit. His predicament would not totally destroy his faith in seeing God and being with Him at last. In which verse? Verse 26. My version says, even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God. Yes. In my flesh. I don't think there'd be any difference there. Even though the body totally gets destroyed, which it was on its way, as Job thought, to doing that, despite that, from that condition, I shall still see God. I think is what he's saying. I'm not going to be totally defeated by this. I have a future. And he knows it's with God. Great faith statement there. Okay. Here's a remark pointed to the friends. Anybody who believes otherwise. Look what he says starting in verse 28. Now, if you say, how shall we persecute him? Now, they didn't say that amongst themselves. Again, the Bible tells us the reason the three friends came from afar was for what reason? To comfort him. They didn't say, let's go beat up on Job. They didn't say that. That's what they're doing, though, by their word. But they didn't come for that purpose. But Job is saying, even if you say, how shall we persecute? What can we do to make Job's life more miserable? And what pretext for a case against him can we find? What charges can we trump up against him? Job says, if you do that, what's his warning to them in verse 29? That's right. God will judge you. And they've been preaching at Job. Now, Job, this is judgment from God. God's getting you for this. That's their sermon. Job is saying, look, I got something to tell you. If you keep making these unfounded charges, God's going to judge you for that. Was that true? We'll find it's very true at the end of the book. God has something to say to the friends that wasn't good. And Job became as priest for them. But we'll cover that when we get to the chapter 42. Okay. Anything through chapter 19? Yes, Charles. Possibly. Yeah, I would say that's true. Chapter 6 and verse 10 is where Charles is taking us. Okay. Yes. Very good. And we have taken the approach when we introduced the book that this is from the days of the patriarchs when God did speak to the fathers. There was no mediator like Moses. This was before the law, the age of the law. So I think Charles' comments are good, that Job has been spoken to in the past. And so whatever knowledge he has from God, he is sharing that at different parts of his speech. Yes, sir. Comments. Yes.
Then that would add to his frustration if God doesn't.
Yes. Because the fact that God spoke in the past, that would raise expectations in Job's mind, would it not? And God is not speaking now. That's a good point. That's a good observation. Job is longing for that communication from God. Okay. All right. Closing words to Bildad prove that he had not completely given up his faith. I think we can see that. Again, that would be Job 19, verses 23 through 29. We see some glimmers of hope there. Some glimmers of his faith. Okay. Now, next to speak is Zophar. This is the last of round two. And this is the last of Zophar's speeches. He will not speak anymore after this. I think I've said that already, but just to remind us that how the speeches break themselves down throughout the book. All right. He's agitated and insulted by Job's word. This is now chapter 20. Look in verse 2. He says, "Therefore my disquieting thoughts make me respond, even because of my inward agitation. I listened to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of my understanding makes me answer." Let's put that in a short sentence. What's he saying? Job, I've been listening to you, and I can't stay quiet. I'm going to say something to what you just said. He feels insulted, agitated, irritated by Job's continual rejection of the friends and their wisdom. Therefore, he must answer. I feel duty-bound to speak up in defense of what Zophar saw was the truth about this situation. And so, like Eliphaz and like Bildad, he's not a bit bashful. He's going to speak up now and say some things about this situation. And he returns to a recurrent theme. They don't venture far off their game plan. He's going to speak about who? The wicked again, verses 4 through 11, and the short-lived success of the wicked. So let's look at these verses real quickly in the time we've got left this morning. Let's start in verse 5. "The triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless momentary. Though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He flies away like a dream, and they cannot find him. Even like a vision of the night, he is chased away. The eye which sees him no more, and his place no longer beholds him. His sons favor the poor, and his hands give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it lies down with him in the dust." Short-lived success of the wicked seems to be what he's saying. Though life would be good for him, and if his head could reach the clouds, if he succeeds to such great heights, Zophar says, what about him in the end? Well, it ain't going to last. It ain't going to last. It's going to come to an end one day because he doesn't have God. Verse 10, his wickedness will even affect his offspring. What will his offspring do based on verse 10? That's right. They won't have his wealth, because they'd eventually lose it, because God will see to that to maintain fairness in the world, and then they'll be begging from the poor. And that's how Zophar saw it. Now again, is that always true with the wicked? No, it's not always true. That's not true. I'm sure that would be true in some cases, yes, but not just blanketly so with those who set themselves at naught against God and live a life in rejection of what God would teach them. His vigor will not help him in his death. You're going to die like everybody else dies. No matter how strong you've been in life, verse 11 concludes, your vigor that was full in your bones at one time in your youth, it'll lie down with you in the dust, just like a weak man in death. You're going to go like everybody else is going to go. Now verse 12, he's going to talk some about the sweetness in the life of the wicked is going to end up how? And Zophar plays on words here. It's going to end up how? Bitter. It won't stay sweet. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it and will not let it go, but he holds it in his mouth. He hangs on to these things, tries to savor them and relish them as long as he can. Verse 14. What's going to happen to it eventually? In his stomach. It's going to get sour or bitter. It will. And Zophar's saying, who will see that it will be done that way? God's going to take care of that. See, God's going to take care of the wicked and how he chooses to live. You may live high on the hog in your life, but in the end, God will. God will get you for that. He won't let you pass in terms of enjoying that success. So the wicked sweet will end bitter. Verses 12 through 14. And God won't allow him to ultimately enjoy the ungodly fruits of his labor. Verses 15 through 19. And we're out of time this morning, but I do want to spend a little bit of time on verse 19. I'd like to save that until Wednesday night. So we'll stop here. And what I want you to do is pick up in verse 12 and continue reading on through the text there and pay special attention to verse 19. And we'll talk about that Wednesday night, the Lord willing. Thank you for your good comments this morning. I really appreciate it.